You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at a new study that shows students of color in particular are negatively impacted by the drinking culture at UW-Madison.
First, immigration has been a hot topic this election season. Here's an exchange from the third presidential debate. This is a couple weeks ago now over immigration and border security. This starts with Donald Trump. You can also hear the voices of debate moderator Chris Wallace and Hillary Clinton.
Under her plan, you have open borders. You would have a disaster on trade, and you will have a disaster with your open borders.
What she doesn't say
is that President Obama has deported millions and millions of people just the way
Secretary
it is.
Clinton, we will not have
open borders.
Well,
that is a rank mischaracterization.
Secretary Clinton.
We will have secure borders, but we will also have reform.
Immigration's not a new issue in the United States. It's a large part of our nation's history. From the first immigrants who came to North America from Europe to the immigrants who are arriving in the United States today, immigration has been both a source of pride and a source of controversy.
Cindy Yifan Cheng joins us now in the studio to talk about the history of immigration in the U.S. and the history of anti-immigrant backlash. She's an associate professor of history and Asian American studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is an ongoing tension. The nation relies on immigrants for the economy, for growth. A large majority of the population here descended from immigrants. But we have this tension about the impact of the latest wave of immigration in the country.
Yes, and it's definitely something that's rooted in history. I think the concept that you guys developed in terms of racial scapegoating is very, very applicable today as well. And what we start to see in terms of patterns is during times of economic recession, anti-immigrant backlash gets to be the height at its height. And historically speaking, this is something that we see happening with the first ever Federal Exclusion Act, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882.
Yeah, let's talk about that as an example. So 1882, I think, railroads and Chinese workers coming into the country to help build from the Pacific East to meet up with the Union Pacific. Huge part of that project, and then a backlash. Can you set the scene for us a little?
Oh, of course. The first important thing to understand is that in 1880, Chinese in the United States only made up 0.2% of the whole entire U.S. population. They were only 8% in California. So these numbers are quite small, and to generate a federal policy for their exclusion shows that there's larger ideologies at work. And in the 1870s, there was a major economic crisis. And there was also a tension within Congress to see whether Democrats or Republicans would regain, you know, control. And during this time, what they started to find as the unifying issue was Chinese exclusion. And workers during economic crisis would feel that the Chinese immigrants were taking their jobs away or undercutting wages. And I think the true alternative in thinking about it is that during this time, could workers organize outside of blood ties or ethnic ties? And if they saw their fellow Chinese workers as fellow workers, could they come together and take on the mantle of labor and challenge the capitalist system for why they're out of work? Talk about the greed of corporations and how that's occurring. But what we start to see is that instead of devoting their energy towards building an inter-ethnic coalition of workers, you start to see workers turning against each other. And here with United States race relations, right, with Chinese immigrants as non-white immigrants and also immigrants that were not allowed naturalized citizenship, you also see why immigrants become a very easy target because they have no political voice. It's very easy to target them because there's no political consequences for doing so. So that it became a national platform, even in states that have never seen a Chinese immigrant.
And we'll dig more into that story in a bit, but it seems like probably you could tell similar stories at various points about Irish immigrants to the United States, Eastern European, Latin America, and even African Americans, freed slaves, not actually immigrants, but a new addition to the paid labor force. Do we see similar tensions between, you know, do these workers unite together regardless of race, or are they divided along the lines of race or ethnicity?
Yes, exactly. And I think that what you start to see, especially in this period, right, is that it was mostly Irish workers not wanting to be at the bottom end mm-hmm. of the totem pole. Dennis Kearney, you know, much of the labor organizers built their kind of platform and on Chinese exclusion. So you really start to see a tension between Irish workers and Chinese workers. And what they did was you start to see the formation of a particular racial capitalism where whiteness was deemed to have a bit more value or entitled to certain kinds of jobs over non-white immigrants. And I think that once again, even labor unionists during that time were critiquing the kind of anti-Chinese exclusion platform, saying that we really have to see each other as coming together as workers, right? And what is going to, the only way that our situation is going to be alleviated is if we critique the system. But just getting rid of these workers, it doesn't mean that their pay is automatically going to increase or their working conditions are going to get better. And it certainly, there were a lot of political cartoons that said, hey, if we get rid of the yellow, who's next? Is it green? To signal that it doesn't actually mean that Irish immigrants' lives were going to be increased because of it.
We're talking to Cindy Yifan Cheng from UW-Madison. She's a professor of history there, looking at the history of immigration in the United States and anti-immigrant laws and backlash. Let's talk about, again, get back to this case study of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So there was this, you call it scapegoating. What ended up happening in terms of law? What changed?
Well, the United States passed, prior to this, we have what we normally call a period of open immigration. And the United States, because of this, and this is why Chinese exclusion has been so studied, it sets the pattern. It creates a particular political culture that in times of economic crisis, what are the actions that we believe can actually fix it? And so the number one thing is we've got to exclude immigrants. And so you have the first ever federal policy, which is actually 1875, which is the Page Act, which was to restrict Chinese women and Chinese contract workers. It wasn't reinforced shortly after we have the first ever act that was enforced, 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which was to ban and bar all Chinese laborers from the United States. And it's the first ever federal legislation to name a particular racial group and class of people for purposes of exclusion. But the legacy of it is that in times of economic crisis, we can jump to the Great Depression. We can even jump to current times, right? That in the Great Depression, you will see another rise of anti-immigrant sentiment. And in the Great Depression is when we began to really actively restrict Latinos from the United States. But prior to that, the borders were fairly porous.
I want to add in the issue of security now. This is an issue big, obviously, since the September 11th attacks. Is there an analogy, though, you had in the era pre and post World War I, anarchist bombing attacks often linked to, rightly or wrongly, immigrant communities? Was that a factor in some of those specific targeted immigrant exclusion laws?
Oh, 100%. Definitely in World War I, and definitely as we go into the period that I study with the Smith Act, right, which is that radical ideologies like communism could never be homegrown. Radical ideologies are like foreigners and immigrants are always imported from abroad, right? And so this deeper sense of xenophobic sentiments, the fear of the foreign, it doesn't just apply to people, but also applies to ideas that workers could not be discontent with their particular situation. To discredit and undermine their critique of capitalism, their critique of big businesses, you immediately say, well, you're influenced by foreigners. And this way it undercuts the legitimacy of their discontent with their class struggle.
So looking at today now, we might look at a few different issues like border security because of fears of terrorism, worries about immigration as an economic issue. I've even seen rolled into it people worried about when Ebola came around, the idea that Ebola might be introduced by terrorist groups or accidentally via the southern border. Do we end up wrapping all these different elements into one common, I guess, fear of a contagion?
Yes, that's an excellent point. What we start to see is that the intersection of using immigration policies to control labor as a way that we believe it actually will fix our recession, and the use of immigration policy as national security, we start to see the intersections. Taking the one about economic recession, for example, we've all been exposed to the news. We understand a lot of the fiscal crisis is related to both the dot-com boom, the subprime investments, and the bad banking. We understand the cause, right? And we understand what it led to a lot of people. Now, intellectually, we understand it. But why is it that the solution is Latino immigrants? How are Latino immigrants responsible for the greed of our financial industry and the subprime mortgages that they lended out? It doesn't make sense. But what happens is the pattern of history, such that we have an economic crisis, immediately we want to solve it. We think getting rid of Latinos is going to actually improve, but that our attention, it just distracts our attention from critiquing the corporate culture, corporate welfare, and what has been done, right? And that's one angle of it. But it bleeds to issue of national security, in that right now what we're starting to see is instead of really spending our money on counter-terrorist programs and measures, what we have used is to use, again, immigration control. And there's so many literature, so many credible studies. And, for example, the Registration Act that required all Arab American, Middle Eastern Muslims to register following the September 11th attack, all male to register, not one person was found to be a terrorist. And what you find actually working is investment in international intelligence, international operations. But this constant racial profiling in the name of national security has actually created a very unsafe place in the United States to be, right? Where with racial profiling, with us looking at each other and thinking that we can tell a loyalty by visually seeing somebody, right? It is kind of the very analogous to the anti-communist hysteria of the early Cold War, where we think we can spy on each other. And I think that's a very, very, very detrimental way of thinking about immigration policy as national security.
We're talking to historian Cindy Ifan Cheng now from UW-Madison, looking at the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash here in the United States.
And we're taking your calls right now, too, at 800-642-1234. Why do you think immigration is so important in this particular election cycle? And what do you think we can learn from the history of immigration in the United States? How has U.S. immigration touched your family? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our discussion now about the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash in the United States with Cindy Ifan Cheng.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your family's history with immigration? What role do you think immigration has played in U.S. history? And what do you think about what our guest is talking about, these cycles of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash, often following up on a big economic dislocation, whether that's the Depression of the 1870s, the 1930s, or the Great Recession we're just coming out of? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Cindy, looking at the economic issues again, I mean, there are divisions today in the Republican Party. In particular, there's a pro-business element that sees immigrants as having a big value for the economy. And then there's a strong element supporting Donald Trump now, saying, no, they're depressing wages for American workers. They're competing for often scarce jobs in communities. Is this something we've seen before?
Oh, yes, of course. And I think that this is the issue here is I would like to kind of unpack it in different levels, right? There's definitely the issue of wanting to use immigrants to work on things as a way not to pay workers a high wage and working conditions. That's definitely an issue, and there's no way of not saying that's a major issue. The question is the solution. Is it always to get rid of immigrants, or is a solution to also not only, you know, to also work with immigrants as fellow workers to contest the system, right? There's also this issue of wanting to see that they are a danger to undercutting. And I think here we have to also really be forthright, because it's not all immigrants that's being targeted. It's not all immigrants that's being a threat to the economy. It's been said very repeatedly, openly in media, that it's Latino immigrants in particular, right? And it's not any job, anything specific. So it's just this unknown threat that they're going to come and take away particular jobs. It's not an industry. We're not. Are we talking about the tech industry? Are we talking about the agriculture industry? What are we actually specifically naming? And I think part of this lumping together becomes not just an anti-immigrant thing, but a very, you know, anti-Latino sentiment that's being bred.
Is there something different when it's the case? Maybe at one point, Irish immigrants or European immigrants were targeted, but immigrants of color, people who, you know, you can look at them, first generation, second generation, third generation, and a sense that, oh, they look different. Does that dynamic play out differently then?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that what we see in terms of the anti-immigrant backlash that's going on today is this intersection of both the fear of the foreign, the xenophobia, and very different kinds of racist sentiments that's happening, right? And so I think that for non-white immigrants, to fully understand what's going on, we have to think about anti-racist measures as well as anti-xenophobia, because it brings both of them together.
So what would anti-racist and anti-xenophobia measures look like, as you're mentioning them?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that these measures, in terms of if we were to really genuinely develop a fair immigration policy, we can't go back to attacking particular nations for being responsible for certain things without saying that is the reason where there's a large Latino immigration coming in the United States, is it because there's been a lot of recruiters from the United States who actively seek out these workers, right? That's the balanced view, right? A lot of times I think people think about balanced view and immigration debate to be there's good immigrants and bad immigrants. The balanced views are immigrants come for jobs, but the United States desperately recruit these workers for these workers, right? And so we have to kind of really look at the broader policies, right? And then also, how do we protect workers in the United States, right, from maintaining their wages and working conditions? We have to really develop these kinds of measures.
Talking to Cindy Efen Chang from UW-Madison. She's a historian there, talking about immigrants and anti-immigrant backlash in American history. We'll go to a caller. We've got Diane on the line in Manitowoc. Diane, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Diane?
Good. My question is, I feel very offensive when people use the term illegal aliens rather than illegal immigrants. And I was just wondering if this is the correct term for people to use the word aliens rather than immigrants. And I find it offensive. And I was just wondering, you know, if you could talk about that.
Diane, thanks for the call. So people do argue over the language. Are we talking about illegal aliens, illegals, people say, or undocumented immigrants? I assume this isn't the first time we've argued about the language we use.
Yes, and thank you so much for that question and also for wanting to work out the complexities of what these kinds of languages mean. I do understand the difference between aliens and immigrants. Aliens just kind of mark people as greater foreign. But I think many of the debates also center around the word illegal. So that when we're referring to people, calling them illegal implies a dehumanization of who they are. So even though as a legal status, they may be illegal immigrants or aliens, when you refer to people, oftentimes people prefer the term undocumented immigrants, because referring the term undocumented suggests that they are still people, right? And there's nothing quote unquote illegal about who they are. They just are people here without documents.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Cindy, you've seen recurring patterns with multiple points in American history. Do you see anything particularly unique or different this time around here in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think in relation to the kind of election cycle in terms of the context and the opening segment that you guys aired is that we are not in an era talking about immigration reform. That has not been the dialogue. We are in an era of open anti-immigrant sentiment and baiting, really, to be able to state. And I think what it's being modeled, right, is that it's the immigration debate is one area where you can say any generalized, negative, very hurtful and very racist things about non-white immigrants. And it's seen as justifiable or permissive. And I think that this is a very damaging thing to foster and to not understand the connection that it has in generating different hostile, intense environments currently that, you know, we have to see the connection. And I think that these kinds of very open, you know, very open anti-immigrant sentiment is it's very, we have not seen it quite this intense in a bit.
So you've seen anti-immigrant sentiment rising after past economic downturns, dislocations in the United States. What has led to them receding in the past? Why do they go away, or do they go away? Do we just keep building on them?
I think they do go away when things start to get better and people are employed and they do not feel that their economic situation is threatened. Those times, it's very, then we start to celebrate the United States as a nation of indigenous populations and immigrants. Then we start to celebrate that the United States is built, you know, on the workers of First Nations people and immigrants. And then we kind of see ourselves as very generous in helping improve people's lives. But during times of economic downturn, I think when people's sense of economic situation is more precarious, I think instead of, it's harder to critique the structural thing, and sometimes the powerlessness that people feel make them turn on people who are even less enfranchised than they are.
In 2016, as we wrap up, do you see that pendulum starting to swing back toward that celebration of immigration?
I think that, again, in this particular current election, what it's brought forward is that no, right? And I don't think, it doesn't matter who gets elected. I think that kind of sentiment is so permissible and out in the open that it's going to be really interesting. And I, being with the university, my commitment is that through education, we can really understand how to, you know, truly treat each other better.
We'll leave it there. Cindy, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you so much.
That's Cindy Yifan Cheng. She's Associate Professor of History and Asian American Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book Citizens of Asian America, Democracy and Race During the Cold War. She joined us on the air today to talk about the history of immigration and anti-immigrant backlash in the United States. Still time for you to share your thoughts on these topics. A lot to talk about there. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. That's a Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR if you can share your thoughts in 140 letters or less. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say.